Let's sit.
No more.
Let's learn. Let's evolve. Let's talk. Today is Let's Talk Business with your host, Jai Lawton.
Welcome to Let's Talk Business. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands we broadcast here in the West End of Brisbane and all across the country, wherever you are listening. I would like to acknowledge the unceded sovereignty of all First Nations people across the many nations in this continent and acknowledge all elders, past and present. Today, we are speaking to Jeremy Donovan, a man of many talents, former Chief Executive Officer of Generation One, keynote speaker and an accomplished and published artist, musician and poet. Jeremy's artwork in 2017 was published by Nescafe and featured on the Nescafe coffee tins and distributed nationally. And you've got a hell of a story and a journey, Jeremy, and I can't wait to get into it. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, brother. It's a proper deadly pleasure and privilege to come in here and check out the new studios, but more importantly, just have a yarn with you.
Yeah, no worries. And as we always do, can we start with your mob and your country?
Yeah, so I'm a Gulkwa Yalan Yemen with also family connections to Gumbangia country down on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. My father's family, my grandfather, was a Gulkwa Yalan Yemen, so we're Nyugal people, so we're Western Yalanji. Our country is around Shipton Flats, so when you travel up through the Daintree, across through Woodjall up the top, is a small little plot of land there that our families come from. And on that Donovan side, which is synonymous with such a famous name, some incredible talent, Emma Donovan is Casey, has really put the names out there. But
my brother Clayton,
Clayton's the champion. So. my grandmother Marlene Donovan, she was born at Barraville, just behind the racecourse up there, and then went to Parramatta Girls Home, and then was taken up as a 17-year-old up to Far North Queensland, and that's sort of where that family sort of blended across up into the Yalanji people up there. So I identify as a Yalanji person. That's where all of my teachings have come from my grandfather, from my father's family, but certainly have a long, history and relationship with, that mid-north coast of New South Wales.
Yeah, and from Chief Executive Officer to, we mentioned at the outset there, and an accomplished published artist and musician and poet, and you've had one hell of a journey to get here, Jeremy. Take us right back to the start.
Or this, probably to address the start, you have to look at my young life as well.
Mm.
And that's probably where it all started. That's probably everything I am today probably was shaped, by the challenges that, that life throws in front of us. And so I have a white mother, an Aboriginal father. I was born at Mossman Gorge, but raised completely removed from family in the care system. And until I was, 13 years old, I was told that I was from a Māori background. And so, as a young, six, seven, from those years where I was in a stable, permanent family, I was raised with a Māori father, Samoan mother. I was told that I was Māori. I was raised with a lot of Māori culture around us, around understanding what tangata whenua is, understanding what mana, all of these things, learning kapa haka.
Mm.
And that's what I was raised with. And then in 1992, I think the Freedom of Information Act changed in 1991, and we were able to find out who the identity of, my biological parents. And it changed my life dramatically, and it probably rocked my life in a really negative way at first, because having grown up surrounded by Polynesian culture as a young person growing up, to find out that I was no longer part of that again, I guess trauma that I didn't understand or couldn't articulate as a, as a young child became very present, because then I thought I was going to be removed from this family again. And ultimately what I did was reject this family that was really stable, really loving. And I removed myself by finding a pathway into prison. And so I was incarcerated for the first time at 13 years old, and then served 11 sentences through my teenage life up into my, two sentences as an adult, and finally, removed myself from that system when I was almost 19 years old. And that's when I took that journey back up home to North Queensland with my father's family. And it would change my life dramatically, because I defined my indigeneity or my aboriginality, whatever you want to call it.
Your identity.
Yeah. Who I was by pain, right? Mm. And and by prison. Like, literally, I remember I was in Sydney. I was at the Bajira Children's Court in Glebe, and I went to the bathroom before I was going before the magistrate. And there was an Aboriginal flag on the back of the toilet door. And I literally made this conscious decision at 13 years old that this is where I'm going to find out who I am as an Aboriginal person.
Mm.
And, you know, the poison of that cycle of, you know, when I was first incarcerated, locked up, all of a sudden I was surrounded by blackfellas. And that's the tragic story, is that, and young Aboriginal men that were just like me, that were lost, that were confused, and we just didn't know where our place was.
Mm.
And that's where that journey started. And for a number of years, it was really negative. It was toxic. It was, and every time I was sentenced, it was progressively getting worse.
Mm.
That there was not one single sentence that made me a better person. Everyone was designed to break you.
Mm.
And so at 16, I was able to meet my family for the first time. It wasn't that functioning because my father was at Lotus Glen prison up in North Queensland. And so I guess I was growing up to be just like him without having any contact in my entire life. And so it was pretty, it was that, but he became a shining light to me. It became like a lighthouse that I would look at him and say that there has to be more to life than what I'm living in myself. And it really did. It, you know, as I was able to go home and live with my grandfather and grandmother, it was the greatest catalyst for change because I could look at what he hadn't had in his life and realize that there had to be more.
Mm.
And my grandfather was, you know, such an incredible old man that just imparted so much knowledge and so much time, you know, for, I think it would have been 1998 when I first went back up home for the first time. And I sat there until, you know, the middle of 2000. And then in the year 2000, I was invited to go to Sydney with the establishment of, you know, Bangarra and some of the dance, you know, theatres down there, and as a didgeridoo player and singing traditional song. And from that, it really would become the elevation or the beginning of my journey, because through music, it would give me a platform to speak when I'd never had a voice before. And then the Sydney Olympics, and like the Cathy Freeman one, which is probably, you know, in my opinion, one of the greatest moments of reconciliation, where reconciliation wasn't a word, that it actually was a feeling.
Mm.
Because, you know, there'd been so much, you know, media leading up to the Olympics, you know, with like Catherine Freeman and the, you know, holding the Aboriginal flag and, you know, sort of the media and the way they portray things and the way they blow things and the way they destroy, you know, sort of this young woman's, you know, connection to her identity.
Mm.
But that night that she won the Olympics was a time where Australia stood up as a nation and just celebrated this incredible achievement. And that night I'd been asked to play didgeridoo in this like little corporate suite and the Australian ambassador to Switzerland was there. And they asked me if I would ever go overseas to play didgeridoo. And at that point, it was the first time I had to be honest with someone that was a stranger about my life in prison. I told people that I'm not allowed to leave this country, that I needed 7 years of no convictions before I could actually apply for passports. And it would change my life because I was given an invitation in 2001 to go across to Geneva to speak at the United Nations at a World Indigenous Peoples Conference. And I would tell my story about, you know, I guess the systemic abuse that, you know, that you experience in these, you know, institutions. And, you know, also, you know, be able to share this story of, you know, of what culture was doing to me and what culture had done to me, because it really transformed my life in terms of just giving me purpose and giving me a dream, you know. And I remember the conversation with my grandfather very early on. And my grandfather asked me, he said, what do you want to be? Like, you can either be another Aboriginal kid in jail, and that number 164320, which was that MID number, is all you're ever going to be. Like, you'll be a statistic, or you can dream to become somebody. And I remember not long after that I'd been given a yigi at didgeridoo, and that became my dream. It was, you know, I guess it was hollow hope.
Mm.
And from that, you know, performing around the world and, you know, sort of playing with, you know, sort of getting the opportunity to be invited to play with different artists and in different places around the world, you know, all the Australian embassies through, you know, DFAT that had invited me to perform in different sections. And then you meet these incredible musicians or, and so the invitations came with the orchestras internationally and, you know, playing in really prestigious, you know, events that this dream to take culture to the world was, you know, sort of becoming a reality that I was living. And, you know, between 2001 and 2012, I literally lived that life of just traveling internationally, predominantly playing didgeridoo around the world, sharing story of culture and sharing essentially stories that my grandfather had just given me. And these stories were his life that I was ultimately afforded the privilege to tell.
Before we get into that that journey overseas, like, just an absolute crazy story, and thank you so much for sharing it. You know, one of just absolute multiple identities, you know, from the, you know, that Māori and Samoan culture and thinking that was who you were as a person, then to the, you know, finding out about your Indigenous ancestry, and then the toxic environment that does become part of the system. And, you know, you got this nonsense at the moment with tough on crime stuff that's happening in Queensland government. And that's a real true testament. You know, you're a young fella trying to find your way and you're not even really understanding what's going on. And yet they're trying to get harder on prison and further incarcerate and lock these kids up. Like, it's just crazy, right?
If you want to just keep increasing the volatility of crime, and we're not talking about young juvenile crime, which is, don't get me wrong, it's causing, you know, a lot of heartache for different families, you know, stolen cars and break-ins. And it does. It you know, unfortunately, it destroys lives in times. But the reality is every juvenile sentence is breaking a young man or young woman and making them more volatile. There is not, prison is not built to rehabilitate. There is no desire to rehabilitate us. It's basically incarcerate, and then you are controlled and you are traumatized. And when you are controlled and traumatized, and then there is no system of support when you get out. And that's probably the most heartbreaking thing, is that it's really, I guess, it's one of these things that I constantly am considering is today, is how do we build a better system that supports a transition from incarceration into surviving and thriving in a life. And locking up teenagers is not going to help. It's not going to, you know, getting tough on crime is not the solution. In fact, you look across this country and there is a bigger issue that is festering within families, within communities where kids feel displaced. Not from necessarily their family, but from the community. From the outside, when they walk outside, they're considered different. And we still have this incredible prejudice and racism that exists in this country. And I think that it's very comfortable to talk about it for us as Murray men that, you know, see it, have experienced it, hear it from our families. But the reality is that conversation needs to be had in the greater Australia. And people need to be confronted with there is abhorrent racism that still exists. There are still policies in place that disadvantage our families. And the other part is our parents, as parents, our ability to be able to raise our kids with any form of discipline. And I'm not talking about flogging our kids, but like that, the ability to, because as parents, we're terrified the system's going to remove our kids because they're so quick to interject and try and remove our kids. And we know this, the forced removal rate is still off the scale. And so parents are disabled by the fact that they want to raise their kids, they want to love their kids, but the moment there's any conversation of discipline or, you know, sort of the perception from community saying, oh, they're not looking after their kids, parents are disempowered, you know. And so there's... As a Māori man, and you know this, there's no shortage of love in our families, in our communities. There is plenty of it. Sure, there is a lot of brokenness within our families. But that brokenness is intergenerational, and it comes from systems of poverty. and disempowerment.
And it can't be solved by the continuing. And, you know, I spent 3 years working inside of the, you know, Brisbane Youth Detention Centre here at Wake Hole, and, you know, seeing it all firsthand as well. And this tough on crime mantra, I mean, it does nothing but appease the public court of opinion and voters to get votes because of that same thing. You know, the public perception is so out of line. You know, even the word discipline, you know, derives from the word disciple, which is to teach, which is far from getting tough on crime. Yeah. And, yeah, anyway, we could talk all day about that. But I do want to, get into, you know, you touched on there before, you know, you've toured the world, more than most, you know, you've did performances globally. And I want to thank Brother David Williams from Galimba there for the intro, because I have been told that you filled 2 passports while you're in your 20s. So tell us about that journey, travelling the world, where you went, what you've seen.
Travelling the world was, and it still is, one of the greatest gifts that you get, I feel, as a performer, and especially as a First Nations man, that there are First Nations people around the world and we connect with, and it felt like constantly for me these greater songlines. And we talk about that, as you know, in on our country and out, but when you're sitting with other First Nations people around the world, it feels like this great jigsaw puzzle of knowledge where songs come together, and they when they collide, they meld together. And that was the highlight of all of the anything that I ever, you know, experienced overseas, was the time spent with First Nations people around the world. And that I've had, you know, sort of the incredible opportunities. I've done Buckingham Palace twice.
Yeah, wow.
You know, sort of performed on the lawns of the White House. You know, played in Carnegie Hall. I've all through Germany and through some of these incredible, you know, buildings and structures, and in all through Italy, France, Germany, Austria, down to Spain, to Portugal. And it's, you know, and then you go across into the Americas and into Asia. It's you see some of the most incredible things that once upon a time were only, could only ever be seen because David Attenborough was taking us to these places. And all of a sudden you're living this life where you're speaking and sitting on the grounds with, you know, sort of First Nations people around the world. And it is the most memorable thing. Whether I've spent a lot of time in Northern America and also in South America, and just sitting with, you know, sort of Navajo or Dene, as they, you know, sort of Dene people and Hopi people, where on Tuba City, where this, you know, sort of on two sides of, you know, within the reservation, you have the Hopi and the Navajo there. And you go down and you visit these messes, and you see these, you know, sort of incredible petroglyphs, and you can make, there's so many stories that these people have that we have, that, you know, they have a different name for it, but they have the same purpose. And all of a sudden you start realizing that we are just part of this incredible picture of, you know, sort of ancient wisdom and culture. And, you know, that goes, you know, I was up the mountains with the Huicholi, in Mexico, and just had an experience. I, you know, traveled, you know, 6 hours up the Amazon on this tiny little tuk-tuk, and had this incredible, you know, experience. I spent 3 weeks up there in an environment where I don't speak Spanish. The people there weren't speaking English. And so for 3 weeks, you know, just drawing in the sand, you know, taking, you know, my experience as an artist and just basically, you know, creating a platform of communication. And it was this incredible experience and this great exchange that I don't think there's no amount of money, there's nothing that could ever, you know, sort of replace that opportunity. So, I mean, traveling the world has been one of the great things. That there are very few places in the world that, you know, I haven't been able to get to, which is an incredible privilege to be able to say that. But the other part is that I come back to this country and have also been afforded an incredible opportunity to travel the length and breadth of this country and spend time, whether with the Australian Literacy and Numeracy Foundation, out with the APY lands, or, you know, through the COVID period, or, you know, I went up into the Kimberleys, although, you know, it had a long relationship working up in a remote community in northeast Kimberley. you know, we just have such a spectacular landscape. We have a spectacular country, and our like and peoples around. When you walk in as an Aboriginal man, we walk in with this, you know, sort of great ability to understand people and to feel people, and we're invited in that particular way as well. Like it's been such a beautiful experience as a musician, as an artist, being able to sit with other Aboriginal artists around this country and just learn their stories, but you know, see how our old people talked about these songs that connect and into I guess entwine themselves, that go right the way across this country. And that's what I've been able to sit and feel.
Unbelievable. And seeing First Nations people operate in colonial structures all around the world, and knowing how backwards we are here in this country, what's there to learn, or what have you seen the lessons that can be learned to apply here?
I think, you know, this country is 30 years behind, 40 years behind other places. New Zealand's the easiest place to have a look at,
mm-hmm.
because it's our neighbouring country. But also, I guess, given the influence of my young life, that you go over to New Zealand, which you take a 2.5-hour plane, and you walk off the aeroplane, and you are greeted with a presence of culture.
Mm.
The moment you walk off the aeroplane, you know there is a presence far that age surpasses, you know, anything that is Western today.
Mm.
And that's the big thing. Whereas here in Australia, and you come through the international airport or the domestic terminals, and I mean, Brisbane Airport probably does it better than anyone, because right now you can walk along and you can see, you know, the photographs, and there's some great historic photographs of Yarrabah and community there. But really, there's no acknowledgement. There's no presence of our people, you know, greeting anyone that arrives. And I know the airlines and the airports are attempting to do things better. And you now, like, you fly, you know, with Qantas, and they've got, like, all the traditional names, you know, that are there, that are saying you're now going to this country. And I think that's a great step in the right direction. But I think as a greater, you know, sort of display of respective culture, it should be the first thing that you see. When you get off an aeroplane in this country, our First Nations people should be the first place, you know, because that's where this country belongs. So I think that, you know, when you go to Canada, and Canada, I think, is very advanced in terms of repairing culture and, you know, sort of making amends for, you know, the pains of the past. Whereas, you know, we are now only just beginning this conversation in this country of acknowledging the pain of the past. And the moment we talk about pain, people are starting to have the ability to listen. Whereas for a long time, it was refuted. The moment we talked about it, it was like, we'll get over it.
Mm.
Wait, hang on a second. You don't just get over it.
Mm. Yeah, and you look at, you know, New Zealand is a good example, and the leadership there through that former Prime Minister Justine Ardern, you know, from the name, you know, Aotearoa, to the treaties, through to the, as you said, everything about it. And while some of it might seem symbolic by nature, but the roots run deep in terms of the systems and the structures and the parliament representation and all other things. It's yeah, it's crazy to see, and it shows the work that we all collectively, you know, I think that's a big thing too, eh? It's not just on blackfellas in this country to do the work. It's on everyone, just, you know, with just the work that Justine did in that space, you know. She could have just went in cruisy and just went with the status quo, but she, yeah.
You know, I think you've got to be brave enough if you're going to get into politics, and unfortunately politics is a place of re-election, right? That's what the concern of politicians today is, purely based around. They don't want reform, they want re-election.
A short 3-year cycle, 4-year cycle, whatever it might be.
Exactly,
yeah.
But create the greatest reform, you know. But people are politicians for a career. You know, they don't see it as just this small term. They see it, how do I preserve my career? They're basing their terms on how they get re-elected.
Mm. Yeah, backward system. Maybe some blackfella systems might be a bit better used there. But anyway, I've got to ask you, you know, you talk about Generation One and the Mindaroo Foundation. It's founded by, you know, the famous Andrew Twiggy Forrest, who's the chairperson of Fortescue Metals Group with his wife Nicola. And he's had a more than colourful history with our mob in this country. And you talk about your story there, and then you talk about this. I've got to ask, firstly, why? And how did this, how was it, what was it like working with someone like Twiggy?
it was a crazy journey, a crazy ride. I remember, like, firsthand how this all came about was in 2012. I'd had Christmas with family back up home, and I saw the poverty and the pain and the lack of employment and the lack of education. And I decided that no longer could I just focus on my career as a performer or as a public speaker, that I was traveling the world and, you know, talking about how powerful culture is and how, but then I was coming home and seeing how broken systems were within my own family. And that's just my own family. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I decided that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to try and make a difference here in this country. I was invited to, it was the Department of Employment at that place, so Doe, it asked me to speak at a National Employment Services Australia conference around employment. Mm. And I was the keynote speaker, and sitting in the audience was Andrew Forrest. And at that point, he asked me if I would be a spokesperson for Generation One. And Generation One at that point was purely around employment.
Mm.
And so I genuinely care about legitimate employment opportunities. I really was naive. I had no idea about what the Australian Employment Covenant was, the AEC, which was this 50,000 jobs campaign. Mm. But I'd stepped into Generation One as a vehicle of addressing employment and overcoming, you know, training for the sake of training. And I believed in those things.
Mm.
I believed that training that led to a guaranteed job was so critical for our families across this country, where, you know, these, you know, sort of RTOs were robbing our communities. They were getting rich on the back of poverty and poverty, you know, of just getting, you know, churning out these pointless training courses. Like, our mob have got more tickets than, you know, tomorrow's Powerball. And that, and that's the truth of it. And but no opportunity. Where are the real roads to employment? And so I believed in this concept that Twiggy had from Fortescue, from the VTEC, from the Vocational Training Employment Centres. I believed that if you trained someone for a job and guaranteed them that job, people would apply themselves and people want to have an opportunity. And there are very few people around this country that I, when I speak to them, and I still speak about employment because I care about that process of affording people an opportunity into employment. Twiggy asked me, would I become the spokesperson? I said, as long as I can become the CEO. Mm. At that point, we had Tim Gartrell as the CEO, then Warren Mundine. And so for the next, you know, six months under advice, Andrew said to me, and I'll never forget, he said, what do you know about being a CEO? And I said, nothing. But I said, you know a lot.
Mm.
You know, and that's the truth of it, is that it was the greatest apprenticeship in understanding business.
Mm.
Because do I agree with everything? But that's my opinion that doesn't necessarily agree. Andrew goes about his business and does his business however he wants to do his business.
Mm.
Would I run my business? Do I believe? Totally not. But what I saw firsthand, and Andrew's not, you know, I'm probably one of the very lucky people in a way that I've been afforded the opportunity to sit with three different billionaires in my career. Mm. And they all are completely different. I probably have to reflect on, you know, if I'm talking about Andrew's ruthless in his business.
Mm.
The time of Generation One and the VTEC, it meant so much to me in terms of the employment space. It was very public. Anything associated with Andrew is very political. But I was the CEO who drove the Vocational Training Employment Centres to the federal government under the Abbott government then, where they committed 5,000 guaranteed jobs. So they basically would fund training that would lead to training for 5,000 jobs. And when you think about, you know, if you multiply 5,000 by 8, that's 40,000 people it's going to affect in our families. And 40,000 is a decent number. And so I believed in that, but I made myself redundant. As the CEO of Generation One, I made myself redundant because I drove it to the federal government where they adopted it and they rolled that out under, you know, the Abbott government, Nigel Scullion as the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs at that time. I then was appointed to be an advisor with Andrew when he did the Forest Review. And I completely agree with some parts of that Forest Review and I completely refute other parts.
Hmm.
And that was the problem, because Andrew believed that you needed to believe in all 26 recommendations or however many. But I fundamentally did not agree with some of the principles around the healthy welfare card. I simply couldn't believe into it. unless you could demonstrate and prove to me the right services were in place to support people. And that's the part that the government weren't addressing. And so I hand on heart, it broke my spirit. You know, that I still was deeply, you know, attached to, you know, culture and performance and art. But this political agenda that I was being positioned to be, you know, to be driving, it destroyed me in a way.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, when you look at it like that, you know, some people go to university to get a business acumen, and you saw that as an opportunity to do an apprenticeship under someone like that for a specific purpose. And who were the other two billionaires?
Yeah, I mean, so before that, you know, the reality is that I don't have any education, you know. So the last years of school, I think I made it through part of year nine, you know. But so education has come for me via sitting with people, you know, so learning from incredible, you know, business people in their own rights. And it's probably one of the things that traveling around the world with DFAT gave me the opportunity, sitting with different ambassadors and you know, diplomats that were the, you know, they were the leaders of whatever their specific field was. And I just listened and learned. And when I didn't understand something, I interjected and would want to learn. And I became fascinated with learning that way.
Inquisitive mind, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. Probably got me in too much trouble, you know. But it's, you know, in terms of the other two, you know, I've been afforded the opportunity to, at times, you know, spend time with Richard Branson, who we know with Virgin Airways and you know, Necker Island and all those different. I mean, is an incredible business person, incredible. I guess is very influential. Is all, and the one thing about these billionaires, they are inspiring when you listen to them talk. And it doesn't matter what your opinion of Andrew Forrest is. When he talks, he has you believing it. And that's probably the danger in some of these people, is that all of a sudden you get enthralled by what they're saying, and all of a sudden you're on the boat and you can't get off. Richard Branson, very kind, very generous, but he's a billionaire in his own right. And you don't become a billionaire without taking extreme risks. And the other one is Sir Frederick Barclay and Sir David Barclay, who probably, you know, they're the monopoly. They're the real-life monopoly people that I've spent a lot of time. They own the Ritz-Carlton in London, and the London Telegraph and or the Herald. I'm not sure which one it is exactly, but, you know, 36,000 staff, you know, incredible people that, you know, sort of had this incredible, you know, have this, you know, beautiful island or, you know, castle in the middle of the, you know, which they do for tax reasons. But, you know, I spent a lot of time working within that family. I remember, you know, being on one of their private jets, and every time I was with them, I looked like their security versus, you know, someone that was actually being invited, you know, to work with them as a family and to share with them. And, you know, whether it just be cut, you know, through, you know, their charitable purposes. And that was the big difference, is that these three billionaire businessmen that I spent a lot of time with were so different in their outlook on people. And, you know, one of the things about Sir Frederick Barclay was he believed in people, you know, and the investment of people. And you say hello to the person that is taking out the wheelie bin the same way you say hello to your managing director. And that, to me, it that was a really big thing, because to me, I hope, and it's, I never want, I feel so comfortable sitting down in the park with our mob that are displaced from home or country or community or homeless, have mental health issues. I'm very comfortable there, but I'm very comfortable in a boardroom too. Like, and I will treat the people in the park the same way I treat the boardroom.
And that's a rare skill to have. And I would, you know, say that doing that apprenticeship under Twiggy, despite maybe some values misalignments and all the rest of it, that's the skills that you learned there. And I'll tell you, not many black fellas can get a billionaire to quote them this. And this is a quote from Sir Frederick Barclay of the Ritz-Carlton in London. Jeremy Donovan is one of the greatest keynote speakers I've ever come across. He has an ability to communicate a message relevant to any audience. And that talks to that piece there from the fellow, you know, from the mob charger in the park through to Richard Branson. Pretty incredible, pretty skill to have. And yeah, it's absolutely mind blowing. Was there ever, you mentioned private jets and all those other things, was there ever a moment where you're just sort of sitting in a room pinching yourself going, what is this black fella doing here that knowing your story and where you've come from are sitting in this time and place now?
Yeah. I think the private jets are the pinnacle of it all, because, and then the boredom sets in, right? So like, I flew to London on a private jet.
Wow. How long is that flight?
You have to stop. We had to stop twice. So you stop in Singapore and then you stop in. And we stopped in Dubai.
And where do you stop? And where do you go?
So it's not like walking through the international airport. You get assigned your own custom officials. They come onto the plane and check you. Yeah, so it's, you know, and then you have chefs on the plane. It's so fantasy, right? But, you know, like I remember the first time flying, you're like, and these waitresses, they, or air hostess, or I don't know, whatever they, I don't know what the appropriate term is, to be honest, today. Because they really are, they manage everything from the flight. They walked on, they were like, what do you want for lunch today?
Wow.
I was like, well, what is there?
And ham and like, cheese toasty?
Yeah, for God. They're like, whatever you like.
Yeah.
I was like, what do you mean, whatever I like? Like, it's, they're like, well, when we stop in Singapore, if you tell us that you want pork belly, we will go and get pork belly and we'll have it cooked and we'll have it for you on the airplane. So you tell us whatever you like. And so I guess being on these private jets is, you know, but then the boredom sets in. You're on this plane by yourself, you know, and because of the people that fly on these planes who like to just be very private and they don't really, no one wanted to yarn.
Yeah.
So I'm loving sitting on the plane just bored, you know.
Where's the crying baby?
I've got ADHD to the max, right? So I can't sit still at the best of times. So I'm walking up and down this plane. I'm, you know, standing on the bed. I'm doing all the, you know, like, things that you just think, what is this surreal life? I think, private jet is probably one of the, you know, it takes it to the, I mean, it makes travel hard. The moment you've been on private jets,
traveling,
you know, back in economy class is really difficult, you know. but, you know, the reality is it's just one of those things that you see, you experience, and, you know, it makes you realize how, like, the absolute privilege and wealth that is out there in this world. And then it sort of brings home, you know, sort of this exorbitant wealth and extreme poverty.
Mm.
And what can be done in the middle.
Yeah.
That's a crazy world in between.
And that's the notion of a capitalist environment, isn't it? You know, you've got the very, very rich, and then, and that's the whole point, is to, and then you've got the very, very poor, which is certainly far from our cultural values. No, thank you very much for your time, and you have been listening to Let's Talk, and if you want to hear more from today or catch another episode of Let's Talk, make sure you head over to our website there at aaa.org.au. Thank you for your company.
No more whispering in our mind.
Let's Talk, Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. on AAA Murray Country, the National Indigenous Radio Service and iHeartRadio. You can catch up on aaa.org.au. Proudly supported by the Community Broadcast Foundation.